Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon. This is J.R. Moore coming to you live from deep in the mountains of the Missouri Ozarks on Sunday, the 28th day of November, year of our Lord, 2010. Welcome to the John Moore Show. Well, it's the last Sunday in November. We've got about 4 weeks left, and it will be 2011. Seems like the year is flying by. It's been, I think I'm wrapping up my fifth year and starting my sixth year at Republic Broadcasting, if I'm not mistaken. I have to go back and check, but I think that's right. Anyway, we've got a number of things to talk about. Senate Bill 510, for example, comes up for a vote, I understand, tomorrow in the United States Senate, Senate Bill 510. Senate Bill 510 has to do with a number of things. I don't have the title of it in front of me here. It's something that they call it the Food Safety Act or some silliness like that. Allegedly, and I haven't, because I say allegedly because I haven't read it for myself, allegedly, you will have to have a permit to grow your own tomatoes in your own backyard. You know, isn't that special? I don't know who they're going to get to enforce this permitting, registration, licensing system. I know out here in my neighborhood, my neighbors, the deputy sheriffs, are not going to take on such a job as that. I can't imagine these conservation agents doing it. And I can't imagine any of my neighbors paying a nickel for a license to grow their own tomatoes in their own backyard. It would be a sight to see. I don't know how they would accomplish this, how they would regulate it. They may attempt to regulate the sellers of the seeds. That would be a real choke point, the people who sell the seeds. That may work for a year or two, but there would be enough people with Heritage Garden Seeds that there would be literally thousands of people doing nothing but growing seeds so that they could in turn sell them to their neighbors. Call the numbers 800-313-9443. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
Got an inside corner on the truth, thanks to John Moore and the Republic Broadcasting Network. To talk to John Moore live on the air, call 1-800-313-9443.
All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th day of November, 2010. Well, the headline at Drudge right now has to do with WikiLeaks and their release of documents. I think it's got to do cable traffic, State Department cable traffic, email traffic. We used to call it cable traffic. They would send telegraphs, but now, of course, we got emails. I'm not sure what all they've released. It's being characterized as being the most damaging ever, which it may very well be. I don't know. I think we could expect that people that are concerned about our republic, concerned about the direction our republic is going, men of goodwill, women of goodwill, with good intent, would do something like this, especially if they're older. If they went to public schools back in the 50s and 60s, this is what we learned. We learned that the bad countries, the evil countries, invade countries at peace. That was what we learned. That's what we were taught. And that's what I believe to be true. I don't know about you, but going to the experience of World War II, we had Japan invading a country at peace, that being China. The Third Reich, the German army, invading a number of countries at peace, Poland and France, countries at peace that had no threat, posed no threat whatsoever to Germany. Italy invaded Ethiopia. That was about as much as they could pull off. You know, the Italian army never was much. So they did what they could do, invade another country at peace, that being Ethiopia. And what I was taught in public schools back in the 50s and 60s is the way you can tell which country is wrong on the wrong side of history, on the wrong side of what's of international law, on the wrong side of what's moral and correct and proper and just, the way you can tell is the country that invades another country at peace is a country that's wrong, the country that's on the wrong side of international law, the country that's on the wrong side of morality. And of course, that's what we have become, haven't we? The United States has become the bad guys. I figured this out when I was in Vietnam. I figured out pretty quickly that I could be sitting there, you know, we got Time Magazine and Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report. You know, it's coming up on Christmas. You're sitting there in a war zone, allegedly fighting communism, and you open up Time Magazine, and there's photographs of the heads of the Communist Party from Russia having cocktails in the White House. At the same time, we're recovering Russian weapons and Russian ammunition off the battlefield, along with Czechoslovakian and Yugoslavian and Hungarian and Polish weapons of war being used against us. That's how I figured out that something wasn't quite right about what we were doing. There was no doubt in my mind that North Vietnam was fighting a proxy war on behalf of Russia and China. The American jet fighters being shot down, they weren't North Vietnamese doing that. That was Russians, Russian technicians operating the Russian anti-aircraft missile systems. That's who was doing that. I'll do a quick segue here. I ran across a book. I've had it in storage here for a couple of years, but I pulled it out. I was doing some cleaning. The Directory of Mail Order Catalogs. This is the 1999 issue. I think 2008 may have been their last edition. The 2008 edition had 992 pages. This earlier edition, 99, has 1,330 pages. It's larger than a big city telephone book. And it's got hundreds and hundreds of companies that offer catalogs in every kind of consumer-related thing that you can imagine. Everything from coffee to firearms. Pretty amazing book. I was looking on Amazon just at the start of the show. The 2008 edition of this book is on Amazon listed used for $52.80. It could be a wealth of information for you if you're a person who likes to do research and find out what's available. Another excellent source, and it's the real mother lode, is the Thomas Directory. Oh my goodness, the Thomas Directory. Now, some of the better libraries will have the Thomas Directory in hardcover, and it takes up about 5 feet of shelf space, a large format book, I believe 11 by 14. Large format book. Each volume is, about 3 inches thick, hardcover. It's the Thomas Register, excuse me. It's not the Thomas Directory, it's the Thomas Register. I misspoke myself, the Thomas Register. Now you might ask, well, John, what is the Thomas Register? Good, I'm glad you asked that question. It lists every company that manufactures anything. Anything, when I say anything, I mean from safety pins to Boeing 747s. Everything that's manufactured is in the Thomas Register. Everything. Now, that's why it takes up 5+ feet of shelf space on a bookshelf. All these volumes. Anything you can imagine that's manufactured is going to be in the Thomas Register. Anything. And if you're doing research and really are sincere about trying to find what's available, what's out there, Well, the Thomas Register will be an absolute gold mine for you. Something else you might find helpful would be the Granger catalog. That's, let's see if I can spell that for you. G-R-A-I-N-G-E-R, Granger. Granger is the largest industrial supply house in the country. And you can hardly go into any, I know you won't, you, if you go into any manufacturing place, you'll find that black, red, and white Granger catalog. It's about 4 inches thick. I don't know how, I don't have a copy at hand here. It's up in my other area. 5 or 6,000 pages, tissue thin pages, tissue thin pieces of paper. Now, obviously, it doesn't have everything that's manufactured. They focus on industrial products that companies need to keep their companies going. From the mundane, like brooms and cleaning products, to generators, electric motors, all kinds of lighting equipment, heating equipment, air conditioning equipment. The Granger catalog is quite comprehensive and quite extensive. Now, keep in mind, if you're going to be shopping in the Granger catalog, you'll be paying full retail. On one hand, on the other, they have what you're looking for, and they have warehouses all over the United States. I doubt there's a state that doesn't have at least one Granger warehouse. I know my hometown, Metropolitan St. Louis, has, I believe, 3, possibly 4. The Granger warehouses spread out in strategic places and typically in industrial parks where people can get what they need. I know in the metropolitan areas they will have next day delivery. Outlying areas it may be 3 working days or so, but Granger is another excellent source just to have that catalog and be able to research and find what all the possibilities are. Now, granted, you're not going to find much in communications equipment, a little bit. Not much in firearms and related things. In fact, nothing at all that I can think of offhand. Maybe you might find some way to secure firearms, some kind of cabinets or safes. But when it comes to other things, let's take gas masks, for example. They will have a good selection of gas masks and a wide range of filters to put on your gas mask. First aid supplies, extensive collection of first aid supplies, first aid kits. A better place to get paramedic-type first aid equipment is GALLS, G-A-L-L-S, G-A-L-L-S, Golf, Alpha, Lima, Lima, Sierra, GALLS.com. Excellent place to get all kinds of paramedic related equipment, complete kits ready to go. In fact, you can get the kits with the bag for portability, or just get the contents of the kit without the bag. And of course, that depends on what you're going to be using it for. So those are some helpful things to help you achieve your goals in preparedness. Something else I like to, I just renewed my subscription to Soldier of Fortune magazine. If you haven't read Soldier of Fortune magazine, you may have a skewed impression of their editorial content. They do not support these never-ending wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Believe it or not, they don't. Break coming up. Call the numbers 800-313-9443. Stay tuned. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th day of November, year of our Lord, 2010. I was talking to Lucas a couple of hours ago. You all know Lucas, the author of the DVD titled The Destroyer Star and the Future of Mankind. Lucas came across some interesting information recently. This has to do with canals. Canals in the state of Louisiana. Canals that predate Caucasians coming to North America. He made reference to a story about Andy Jackson and the War of 1812 and how when Andy Jackson was preparing his defenses, he had his men dig a moat, and that moat was connected to, quote-unquote, a pre-existing canal. Apparently, these canals predate Christopher Columbus coming to North America, that if you were to draw a straight line from where these canals go out into the Gulf of Mexico and continue the straight line, you would find where the canal comes up again on an island out in the Gulf of Mexico. Lucas believes, and I concur with Lucas, that these canals were dug before the oceans came up 500-something feet, about 11,000 years ago. I say about because we really don't know. There's no specific date. He and I also talked briefly about how Google Earth has blocked out images between Florida and Cuba. It's just blacked out. Now, the reason being, he feels, and once again I concur, is that there are man-made structures underneath the ocean between Florida and Cuba, that if the images weren't blocked out, you'd be able to see them. Things you can't see from a boat. You're just too close. They're too big. These objects are too large to see just looking straight down from 10 feet or 20 feet or 50 feet above them. You have to be a couple of thousand feet up to see buildings. And we're talking, of course, the possibility of pyramids, probably roads, other structures underneath the ocean between Florida and Cuba. There's been some of these structures have been photographs have been released, and we are aware of them, a few. But more likely than not, once word gets out, and it may take some people flying back and forth at somewhere between 2,000 and 5,000 feet above the ocean with some camera equipment to really figure out what's going on down there underneath the ocean. But I think once these images are released, it will really tell the tale of a whole civilization that it was wiped out by rising ocean levels 11,000+ years ago. So what's the point of it, John? Why am I talking about this on Sunday the 28th of November 2010? Here's the point. Human beings occupying this planet go through cycles. Cycles of rising up out of the mud and literally Stone Age existence to high levels of technology, only to be smashed back down to the mud by earth changes and having to start all over from scratch. That's the nature of human beings occupying this planet. And what I'm seeing, what I'm learning, tells me we may be at the precipice. We may be at the edge of this cycle starting all over again. That's the best information I can get, is that we may be at the edge. I'm corresponding with some people in the United Kingdom, in the British Isles, about what's going on over there. They're already starting to have snows early. They've had snows already for a week in the UK. Now, it's been 17 years since they've had an early snowfall, and I believe what we're going to see in the winter of 2010-2011 is that the freakish and the abnormal will become the normal. I believe that's what we're going to be seeing. And it's less than 4 weeks before the first day of winter, December 21st, and we shall see if what used to be freakish and abnormal is in the process of becoming a new normal. Got our first caller on hold here, John in Austin. How you doing, John?
Hey, John, how are you?
Real good. What's on your mind?
Oh, well, I was kind of going back to some of your supply sources.
Right.
Right, and wanted to add one for everybody.
Okay, go ahead.
Called SAR, S-A-R, Sam Alpha Romeo.
Gotcha.
SAR Camp. If they Google that or search engine SAR Camp,
okay,
it's a wonderful supply house for items used by search and rescue teams.
Oh, okay.
They would have all the climbing
equipment. Hold on, John, through the break here. Let's talk about this some more. I'm interested in this. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
John Moore is as close as your telephone. Call him right now, 1-800-313-9443.
All right, we're back. Ladies and gentlemen, we're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th day of November. John, are you still there, sir?
Yes, sir.
Okay, now off the air, you and I agreed that we would talk a little bit about SAR Camp and also rock climbing, rappelling, and high angle rescue. I'm a rock climber. You're a rock climber. It's been a while. I'm not sure how long it's been since I talked about rock climber or anything like that on the air. So it'll be fun, and maybe people can learn a little bit. You're undergoing some training right now, you say? What is that training?
We've been training for what we call high angle rescue, which is basically taking an injured person off the side of a cliff from an elevated area.
Right.
And that could be everything from the top of a roof to, like I say, we have some cliffs here and people fall and get trapped on ledges.
Right.
And being able to safely work down to these people. Plus, there are times that you need to be able to lower equipment yourself and your team. It could be only 20, 25 feet, but it would save you hours of having to go around something.
Absolutely. Well, I want to focus on a couple of things. First and foremost, safety and training.
Yeah,
you can hurt yourself so quick doing these activities.
Yes.
Make your head spin, and then on equipment, and then practical applications.
Sure.
As people may be sitting there thinking, well, I'm not, I don't plan on getting stuck or rescuing anybody.
Yeah.
How far into the training are you at this point?
I am where I have what we call a level one. Which is I can go down on rappel, rig up a Stokes basket, and help lower that Stokes basket.
Describe a Stokes basket for people that don't know what that is.
Okay, if any of y'all have seen the, it would be a basically either wire mesh or fiberglass rectangular basket, if you will, that you would put a victim into and strap them in so that you can move them or carry them.
Right.
Safely.
Right.
And it has multiple attachment points and handholds so that, quite a few people can get on it.
Right.
Maybe 6 to 8 people, which,
okay,
believe it or not, to carry a full-size adult, 6 to 8 people through rough terrain, you get pretty tired doing that.
Yeah, you would. I assume they teach you that lowering a person down who's been secured in one of these is far easier and safer than trying to hoist them to the top of a cliff.
Right, about 90% of the time. There are some exceptions, but 90% of the time it's easier to go down and up. And to go up, you have to have a different kind of specialized equipment. to do it properly. Now,
go ahead.
Basically, for training, there's various ways to train. Most search and rescue teams will offer some level of this training, either at no cost or a reduced cost.
Right.
And Absolutely. It doesn't have to be, the training can be everything from going down a very steep incline, okay, going up, and or sheer faces where you're doing vertical drops, or combinations. So you can get your training, or you can go to certain schools that teach this. More and more, you've seen where they have the little rock climbing walls.
Right.
And everything. And that can be a very good basic introduction, because they teach usually the rock climbing on one side of the wall and the rappelling on the other.
Right. In fact, some of the REI stores have those set up inside the store. The one in St. Louis does.
Yeah. And equipment, what we carry as our basic kit, we carry 2 to 4 D-rings, aluminum D-rings rated to 5,000 pound test.
And I call them carabiners. You're talking about open gate or locking gate carabiners?
Right, exactly.
Locking gate, okay.
Right. You want a locking gate beaner, your harness, okay, which needs to be ANSI, for us in the rescue, they're ANSI approved, which means that they take a certain load-bearing weight,
right,
and have certain safety features. I highly recommend that.
You have the harnesses you use, are they padded?
No.
So okay.
You can get them. So, believe me, I have enough natural padding now, John.
Okay, don't give yourself away here, John.
I'm the guy that they threaten to put in the Stokes basket.
You mean threaten everybody else with?
Yes. If guys act up, we're putting John in the basket.
Okay.
Right? And
that gets them to straighten up, doesn't it?
Yes, sir. And you have your harness. You have your locking gate carabiners, a rescue 8, which is a way of controlling the rope and keeping the rope from tangling on a rappelling.
Are you talking about a figure 8 descender?
Right, with the horns.
Right. Oh, with the horns. Okay. I've got a bunch of descenders. I don't have one with horns, though.
Right.
You think that helps keep you from getting turned upside down?
Yes.
That's pretty humiliating, isn't it?
And disconcerting, especially if you haven't tightened your harness up.
Well, let me describe a couple of rappels I've done in training and in real life. One, we were, this was with Special Forces of A-Team I was with. We were going cross country at night, and we had to rappel down a cliff at night with a 40-pound backpack, weapon, and helmet. We did have a guy who managed to get turned upside down at night on the side of a rock cliff. And I don't recall if somebody had to rappel down and get him back up upright or not, but he was certainly thoroughly humiliated about that, and I think he lost a piece of equipment in the meantime. Another rappel I did, this was a ham radio installation. The guy had a house at the bottom of a cliff, and it was almost a sheer rock cliff going 100 feet above the home. And we, because of squirrels possibly eating through the coax, we put the coax inside a half-inch garden hose. And it was 125, 150 feet all looped up that I put on my back. And I rappelled down this cliff using cable ties as I went to cable tie the coax to saplings and anything I could find to secure it so it wouldn't blow around in the wind all the way down to the house.
Right.
So that was a nice Saturday afternoon. But I've seen people, you probably have too, John, they just want to do, especially young men between, say, 15 and 30 years old. All they want to do is learn how to rappel. Have you ran into that?
Oh, yeah. But that and rappel is like, you know, and we usually have a way of breaking that.
And then what's your technique?
We rappel them into an area where basically the only way out is to climb out.
Oh, good. Yeah. Okay. I like that. I like that.
And so, or take like a 5-mile hike to get back.
Right. Right.
You know, but you see people getting the proper training. It's not hard, but having the proper training is crucial. Probably the most common accident you see is where, on your control hand for your rappel, where you're actually controlling the rope.
Right, the hand behind on your tailbone, right.
Right, and people will lose that hand in the sense that they'll let it roll forward and then it'll catch into the carabiner. And
I could see where that could happen. That'd be pretty painful if it did. Or just get the hand out to the side where you lose all your leverage.
Right, and there have been situations where you have to take someone's thumb off or something like that to get them out of that situation.
Take it off as in cut it off?
Yes.
Oh, baby.
So you want to know what you're doing.
Well, you do. One of the things... Go ahead.
and that's usually on where you have a free vertical descent where you're actually just in the... going down the rope, like, you know, from a helicopter or on the side of a cliff that might have a cutaway, and cutaway you might your last 50, 100 feet free.
Right.
You're not touching anything. You're just going down a rope.
Right. That would be – I would not let somebody inexperienced do something like that. That's a real advanced technique, that free rappel like that. A novice has no business, in my opinion, doing that kind of free rappel. What do you think?
Unless it's life or death, but yeah, absolutely.
Well, obviously life or death.
With our team and in our academy, we start you off on a slope, and you start going down a slope,
right,
of a hill, and then we then move up to a little 12-foot rappel.
Mm-hmm.
And then we move up to a 50-foot, and then we start adding, above 50 feet, we start adding irregular surfaces and things of this nature. And then once you complete, then, of course, you have to be able to learn the knots. You have to be able not only to rappel, but you also... have to know how to belay and be able to set up the entire rappelling station where you have the rappelling rope and the belays and set everything up properly, have everything safeguards and everything set up with the proper knots and proper equipment.
Right, Well, if rappelling is taught properly and done correctly, it's a very safe thing to do if you follow all the safety guidelines.
Right, and I initially learned in Outward Bound school. I went to a partial mountaineering school. It was a mountaineering and tracking school.
Right.
And so I learned there, and then re-emphasized again in search and rescue. With probably the neatest rappel I ever did was off the side of an overpass about 60 feet into a ravine.
All right.
And I wasn't planning on it, actually, but one of our guys got hurt. And so as team medic, I went down and had to go down with not only my SAR equipment, but also my medical bag.
Right.
And get down there and take care of business. See, then, you know, there's a whole plethora of equipment. And having a set of ascenders with prussic lines on them is really handy if you're going up something. And an ascender allows you to slide this handle. If people can picture sort of a handle with a one-way cam lock in it,
right,
they can push forward up, and then it locks back down under pressure.
Right.
And you have a prussic line, which would be a long piece of webbing in a loop that you have your foot in. And you have one for each foot. And you can literally just kind of, it's kind of like get a stair step, kind of funky stair step motion.
It is, yeah.
And you can move up a vertical line like that fairly easily.
It is. It takes a tremendous amount of energy to move 50 feet using ascenders. I've got a couple of different pairs, and I like them, and I use them if I have to. But it's a safe way to move up a single rope when, quite frankly, there is no other way to do it.
Right. And so having one or two of those, your locking D-rings, and, of course, the type of rope. And I believe RBN has a company that advertises rope.
Really? I miss that. I wonder, I'll have to check out the website.
They offer climbing rope, and there's a big difference between climbing rope and rappelling rope.
Right. Well, the climbing rope's going to have is going to not have a lot of give to it.
And right. Or your rappelling line is going to have some spring to it.
Right. Right. Exactly. Now, typically people only get one or the other. If you want the if you can only get one, get the one that doesn't get any give. That's what I get myself.
Yeah.
I don't know what your opinion is. Do you have an opinion on that one way or the other?
No, not one way or the other.
Okay.
I mean, once again, I'm getting of the gravitational resistance where it gives. You don't want to bungee jump after me, John.
No. Well, that brings up something. Unless you know the person you're getting used equipment from, I would never, ever buy used climbing equipment.
No.
Especially rope. I can look at a figure eight descender and see if it's got any fractures or damage from what we might call adventure training rappelling. And you really can damage your equipment doing this leapfrog adventure rappelling.
Right. And
Hollywood type stuff, can't you?
Yeah, the aluminum, especially aluminum.
Right, it'll cut. It'll cut through the aluminum.
And I've noticed recently that finding steel has been real hard.
Really?
Yeah, there's been a shortage in my area where I live.
Okay.
And so if I wanted steel, and I don't mind the carrying aluminum, actually, you just have to be a little more careful with them.
Right, right.
I carry, like I say, I carry four locking gate carabiners,
right,
a rescue eight, and a rack, which is a way of locking a rope. Like if you're rappelling and you need to stop, you can lock your rope down.
Right, right.
So, and that's so like if I'm working with a patient or victim, I can lower down to the Stokes basket and have both.
Hold on, John. Hold on. We got a break coming up. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back. We're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th of November. John, are you still there, sir?
Yes, sir. A couple of things I want to jump on real fast, John.
Yeah.
That are really helpful for people regarding rope. Most people buy their rope for these purposes at a minimum of 150 feet
right,
to 250 feet.
Right.
250 feet of continuous rope, climbing or rappelling rope, is a heavy thing to carry.
Oh, my goodness. Oh, yes.
Now, with regard to rope, here's a little secret I found living in the big city. These window washers who do the sort of rappelling type work off the cleaning
right,
windows.
Yep.
They sell their ropes once they've hit their end of their safe, useful life.
Uh-huh.
And the ropes are still very viable, not for climbing. You don't want to be at the end of one, but for using for anchor rope and having tie-down rope, and they sell it for pennies a foot.
I would think they would, yeah.
And let me tell you, and it's good quality rope, and it still has a lot of life left in it. And so for anchor ropes and stuff like that, I would buy that and use that for anchor rope.
I generally use one-inch tubing myself for those purposes. It's a lot lighter than rope. It has about 6,000 pounds of strength to it. It's easy to work with. You can tie knots in it very easily. I also use one-inch tubing for tying my own Swiss seats, and I always teach my students how to tie their own Swiss seats.
We do the same thing. In fact, I was going to mention that we carry 40 to 60 feet of webbing on us as part of our standard kit.
Right. I usually my kit. I will have typically about 4 pieces of 1-inch tubing, maybe 14, 16 feet long, with of course the ends burned off so that they won't unravel. Right. And use them individually, or I can tie them together if I need to make longer pieces.
And we have enough that we can, like, strap someone into a Stokes basket or rig a splint or do what we need to make a Swiss seat or even throw it out. Like, if you're going up a steep upgrade, you can pull that out of your pocket and toss it down to the guy below you and help him out.
Right.
Now, I want to tell people to avoid something like the plague, and you see it in some of the catalogs like Cav and different. They sell, I have seen the micro repelling kits, which uses 550 paracord.
Really?
Yes. And this is like the fourth and long James Bond, the world is crashing in on my head, I got to get out of here. And that's all it's designed to do.
Yeah.
And you need to have great faith in the man above and a good insurance policy for your loved ones, next of kin, and go for it. The only thing scare me about using the 550 paracord, but the line is so thin that the possibility of getting severe rope burns and controlling the line is difficult. From what I've known a few guys who've tested it out, and they were able to do it, but they were young, light guys.
Right.
I wouldn't do it. I wouldn't spend the money for it.
I wasn't aware of the. And I haven't looked at these catalogs maybe for a year or so. It must be. It sounds like a fairly new piece.
No, they've been around for about 4 or 5 years, John. Yeah. You just don't see it that often, and it's kind of a thing. It fits in a very small pouch.
Right.
And it'll be like a last-ditch rescue item. You'll see the smoke jumpers. You have them.
You want to hold on to the break here, John?
If you want me to, John.
Yeah, let's do that. We're doing some good conversation. Stay tuned. We got a top-of-the-hour break. We'll be right back. Good afternoon. We're back, ladies and gentlemen. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th day of November, year of our Lord, 2010. Welcome back to the John Moore Show. Well, before we get back to talking about search and rescue, in particular rock climbing and rappelling and all that, I need to let you know about the Freeze Dry Guys November special. Freeze Dry Guys November special. He has economy-sized buckets of freeze-dried food, breakfast and entree units, and hearty-sized buckets of freeze-dried hearty breakfast and entree units. Now, going out to the economy size, he starts out at 15 days worth of food. That's 56 one-cup servings for $115. It may sound like a lot of money, but you figure out what it costs you to eat for 2 weeks, and you'll see this is a value, considering that it will keep basically for decades and be just as healthy and nutritious 30 years from now as it is right now. Ranging up to a 12-month supply, a full year for one person, $2,760. That's 1,344 one-cup servings. shipping included, for $2,760. Now we move up to the hardy size buckets. 2 week supply, it's actually 15 days, of hardy size breakfast and entree units for $170. It's 84 one-cup servings, ranging up to a full year of, well, let's go to 6 months. The page got cut off here. 6 months of hardy breakfast and entree units. That's 1,008 one-cup servings for $2,040. Half a year of food, shipping included. Now, freeze-dry guys out there on the left coast, give them a call tomorrow morning, Pacific business time, at 866-404-3663. I say again, 866-404-3663. His website, of course, is freezedryguy.com, and there's a link for my website, Liberty Man. Stay tuned. We'll be right back.
John Moore is taking your telephone calls right now on the Republic Broadcasting Network. Pick up the phone and join in the conversation. Call 1-800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443. And thanks for listening to RBN.
All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th of November. John, are you still there, sir?
Yeah.
Talk a little bit, if you would, please, about proper care and feeding of rope, if you would.
Proper care. First of all, your climbing ropes are your climbing ropes. They're not to be used for anything else.
I mean, you can't tow your neighbor's truck out of a ditch with it?
Don't tow your neighbor's truck out of the mud, right? Don't let the kids grab it and go play with it. You don't step on them. We have a rule. If you step on a rope, you got to apologize to the rope, then get down on your hands and knees and kiss the spot you stepped on.
I like that. Well, personally, I never let my rope get wet.
Right.
Never step on it. I make sure that going over the edge of a rock or concrete or whatever it might be, that the rope is protected by a blanket, a field jacket, equipment bag, something to protect the rope from making direct contact with the edge of that rock.
Now, I'll tell you one of the best things you can get, if you go by an old firehouse and you find out where they're cutting up fire hose,
right?
Get you some lengths of fire hose, and you can make a lot of cool stuff out of that.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Slit it down the end, put a little Velcro around it, and you can make a 7 or 8 foot long protective sleeve,
right,
that where the rope actually goes over the side or at any point where it touches the ground, like if you're using a tree as an anchor,
right,
and you can slip that around the rope or wrap it around the rope or the tree, and the less abrasion the better.
But right,
you visually inspect the ropes before and after each use. And we have a rope log that we keep.
Yeah, if you got multiple people using ropes, mine are never out of my sight, but I can see where a rope log would be. Describe a rope log and what it is physically and how its entries are made and so forth.
A rope log basically will have the basic information of who you got it from, the specification of the rope. Okay.
Right.
Then it is cataloged for each use with the number of people who went down the rope. Okay.
Right.
Then it has a checkoff point for pre-inspection and post-inspection. And then it's signed off after each use.
I like it.
Then if any faults are found in the rope, if they are found at such a point where the fault can be cut out and still maintain the rope, that's documented. And then once the rope has hit its serviceable the end of its serviceable life, then the rope, we cut our ropes up into small sections that can't be used.
Now, I'll tell you the way I was trying to do, initially trying to do rappelling with special forces, we used 14-foot lengths of green line to build our Swiss seats with.
Right.
Oh, baby. Now, talk about uncomfortable. It's safe. It's incredibly safe, but it's about the most uncomfortable Swiss seat you'll ever make in your life is well, to make it out of green line.
That's why I have my own seat and harness. Old Paw likes comfort.
Yep.
And a lot of us use full body harnesses now.
You mean like construction workers?
Right, and that way, when we come down, if we have a victim on a ledge, we can get them in a harness and clip them to multiple points.
Of course, the full body harness, the construction workers wear, they got their ring on the back side.
Well, these have rings on the back and front and hips.
Okay, all right.
These are rescue harnesses, John.
Okay.
And the other nice thing about a full harness, if you do invert, and your seat, maybe you didn't have it. If you have a little bum, you're not going to wiggle out of that.
Yeah, well, you can't come loose. But when you're doing a full body harness, where do you clip onto at the chest or at the waist?
At the waist.
Okay, but does it run through the?
Like a regular seat harness, John.
Uh huh.
It's just got some extra attachment points. That if you are working with a victim and allow you to secure that victim to yourself and then free a hand up, and everything. Because taking a victim down, like attaching another person, changes your rappelling dynamics dramatically.
Well, it would, and depending on...
Normally,
on the side of a cliff, it'd be tough. It would be real tough.
Especially,
you ever had to do a rescue of an unconscious person under those conditions?
Simulated,
yeah.
What we do when we train as close to we'll do a dry train where we actually on the a ground train where we actually go through the motions on the ground and rig it up and do everything. And then we'll take it up, and we use a place called Enchanted Rock here, which is outside of in Central Texas, and it's a large granite dome.
Okay.
And it has various faces, surfaces. Some are slick as glass, and some aren't, and some are vertical, and some are real steep angle.
Right. Right.
And we train with a live body in the basket.
Well, that's good. You ever do any training at night?
Yes.
Okay.
How we train when we have a victim is when we shoot for the 60-minute, the golden hour.
Right.
And our golden hour is from point of contact to the landing zone.
Okay.
Or pickup point.
Right.
And that's the ultimate goal is to be able to get someone off. You know, we don't have high mountains and everything here in Central Texas.
Right, right,
right.
Well, let me give people a heads up. Another practical use for all this. I'm always encouraging people to get their communication skills, and when it comes to climbing a tower. Install antenna, repair antenna, replace coax, whatever it might be. These skills, ladies and gentlemen, can make the difference between doing it safely or getting hurt or not doing it at all. You've got your climbing skills, you got your Swiss seat, you got your locking carabiners. You can safely climb a tower. You get up to where you need to be to work on the coax or work on the antenna. You secure yourself with your equipment. And you're locking D-rings, you're locking carabiners, and then you can work and have both hands free,
mm-hmm. you know,
and confidently have both hands free while you safely work on the antenna, replace or repair coax, whatever it might be.
one of the other things too, John, with the carabiners and seats and everything, not using the rope, using a different rope, but let's say you were in a whiteout condition in a snowstorm.
Yeah.
You can you can hook everyone up together and keep everyone together.
Absolutely.
Some of this equipment crosses over to Swiftwater Rescue.
It would, absolutely.
For safety precautions for fording rivers, for fording frozen lakes and streams, for being in areas where there could be snow-covered crevasses. There's a lot of non-climbing application to the equipment.
Well, and here's another aspect of all this we haven't talked about. You know, let's say you're working with a team. It could be just you and your spouse, or maybe several other individuals, several men and women, anybody 12 years of age and older. Learning how to use this equipment properly and safely is a way to build confidence in people, to help them feel more confident about themselves, their capabilities, their ability to take on a what appears to be, and quite frankly is, a life-threatening challenge, and overcome that life-threatening challenge through use of their training, their skills, and their equipment.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes you a better person. That makes you a better person, in my opinion.
Yeah, and the team building, like we worked with a bunch of the Civil Air Patrol cadets and took them out and trained some of them. And we had this little 12-year-old guy, and he was scared to death.
Oh, yeah.
And he finally mustered enough to go do it. And it was just a little 15-foot rappel.
Right.
And we couldn't keep him off the rope after that.
That reminds me, one of the training things I do, I'll take a big guy. Are you, give or take a few pounds, are you around 250, John?
230.
Okay. A big guy like yourself. Coming down off a granite boulder, and I'll have a 12-year-old girl who might weigh 85 pounds on belay below, you know, belaying from below, and I will have her put her all of her 85 pounds into the rope and lock up the 230-pound guy coming down, just to show how the leverage works on this equipment and how an 85-pound girl can quite safely be a belay for a 230-pound man.
Right. And if you have some pulleys added to your equipment and you have an understanding of what you're doing, let's say you're out in the boonies.
Hold on, John. We got a break. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back. We're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th of November. John, tell us about the headgear you guys wear when you're doing your rock climbing.
Okay. Once again, rock climbing helmets are a little different than what you would find for, like, the kayaking helmets and things of this nature. There are no holes or vents. We're not allowed to have holes or vents.
No. Well, basically, a rock climbing helmet is a construction hard hat with the visor cut off and a chin strap.
Well, maybe yours.
That's what I got. In fact, sometimes I'll use a construction hard hat and just turn it backwards and put a chin strap on it.
Here's the thing about a climbing helmet, what you want to look for. First of all, you want a suspension system as opposed to a padded system like in a military helmet.
Right.
Right, because if you're getting a rock landing on your head, you basically want the shock absorbed around your head, not onto your head.
Exactly.
Some of us have face shields, some of us don't, and that's real helpful, especially where we are, because if people are above you, and they're knocking scree, so having some kind of eye protection is good. safety glasses or goggles, right. Because people knock scree up above you and that stuff comes down in your face.
Gravel, right.
The ANSI, which is a certification agency, and the NFPA now want all the SAR guys' helmets to not have that. Our helmets double as firefighting helmets, to woodland firefighting helmets.
Oh, really? Okay.
And they have a special type helmet, and they're about $235 a pop.
Whoa, baby!
They're Kevlar, no holes or vent holes in it to let the heat out, so that way no embers get in.
Well, yeah.
Yeah. And you want the suspension system. You can pick up good rock climbing, basic rock climbing helmets for about $30 to $43.
Yeah, that's about right. Yeah.
You want to avoid red. Red is traditionally a instructor's color.
Oh, okay.
Plus, you want something a little more visible. But red is traditionally the master or instructor or supervisor on site.
Yeah, that's the same thing on the rifle range. The range master wears red hats, right?
Right. And
In fact, the military just calls them red hats.
Right. And you also want some good elbow and knee pads when you're.
Yeah, that's something we didn't do that when we were training 30 years ago in the military. Elbows and knee pads were unheard of. We thought they were for sissies, but it makes a lot of sense.
Well, if you're on the side of a shale rock cliff with a lot of rock jutting out, and you slip and jam your knee into a rock with any kind of force and catch an edge into your kneecap, it's going to hurt.
It's going to hurt, and it could incapacitate you. I believe I'd get the knee pads before I would the elbow pads, but I can see where both could be useful.
Well, as doing the medic thing, sometimes I find myself in not as good a position as I want to be in.
Right.
And so I'm anchoring on my elbow or something like that. And it just... Yeah, it just, once again, it's a comfort thing, and it's a requirement now that we have them when we go into disaster areas.
Now, do you use more of a tactical type, or is it more of a rock climbing type of device?
I use tactical.
Okay.
Like the Voodoo, right. Or the hard shell.
Right. Yeah, you want the hard shell, absolutely.
Yeah. Yep. And then the closed foam underneath it.
Mm-hmm. That's what you want. Yep.
And Velcro on. I don't use the neoprene ones that slide. I just want something that Velcros on and off.
Right. Right. Well, that makes absolute sense, and that's what I would do also. I've had some knee injuries, and they're incredibly painful and can be you can still function usually, but it just slows everything down and is incredibly painful.
Now, the other thing, a real important thing, is your rappelling glove.
Tell us about what you use. Yeah.
I use what they call a fast rope glove on my right hand. And it's a thick, heavy glove that has a triple lining in the palm. So that as the rope slides through my hand, it dissipates the heat.
Right.
Because it will build up a tremendous amount of heat.
It does. Have you ever tried fast rope?
Yes.
Okay. How did it work out for you?
It would have probably looked like extreme repelling.
Uh-huh.
What kids call extreme repelling now, I used to call an accident.
Okay. Yeah.
You can imagine a 230-pound buffalo coming down at you.
Okay, well, I'll tell you about my fast rope experience. I was on a tower. It was a training operation, and we got a break. Stay tuned, everyone. We'll be right back.
Wake up, America.
Open the door.
It's time for us to Face the Truth with John Moore. Now, if you want to talk to John live on the air, call 1-800-313-9443. That's 1-800-313-9443.
All right, we're back, ladies and gentlemen. We're back. This is J.R. Moore. It is Sunday, the 28th of November. Well, Christmas is coming up. You have somebody special on your list that is living in the Matrix, needs to be woke up, a spouse, sibling, parents, adult children. My best-selling DVD, Global Warming, What the Government Isn't Telling You, has been proven time and time again to be just a ticket where you're talking to them didn't work. Maybe books you provided didn't work, or other DVDs. My DVD, Global Warming, What the Government Is Telling You, has been proven time and again to be just a ticket to wake people up to the fact that they're living in the Matrix and the absolute fraudulent nature of what most people think is global warming, how it's a cover story for something else far more worse, far worse, and in our face. You may want to go to my website, thelibertyman.com, and read my article, my most recent article, The Gulf Stream Has Stopped. There's real science there, with backed up with real scientific locations you can go to, like the United States Navy website, for example. U.S. Navy, every 24 hours, publishes a new map with all the temperatures of the oceans all over the planet. Yes, in fact, the Gulf Stream has stopped. I initially warned people of this in my paper, first published in 2005, No Need for Panic. And this is real. This is a fact of life, backed up by real science. Do your own homework. Don't take the word of a radio talk show host, a homicide detective. Do your own homework. Check out the references and prove it to yourself. My website is thelibertyman.com, and I do have a toll-free auto line 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. That's 800-592-9543. I say again, 800-592-9543. John, are you still there, sir?
Yes, sir. Still
okay.
With you.
Well, we were going to talk about my... I've only done fast rope one time, and I didn't. Something didn't work out properly. I ended up with third-degree burns on my calf and my thigh from going down this rope in what I thought was a proper manner, and I haven't done it since. So that's my experience at fast rope.
Well, I did it. Part of what I had some training when I was over in the North Sea as a diver,
right,
or diver rescue, and to come out of a helicopter.
Right.
Full scuba gear and drop into the water and then do the flying wing to come out with four of us.